our ability to hear from God is often sharpened in moments where it requires sacrifice. I very much felt the call on my life with God saying, listen, you have obeyed me and I have blessed you. Now, what are you willing to sacrifice to serve? That question echoed in my heart. It came from my realization that the material success can't be the end all and be all, that life has to be richer than this.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. I was so confused as a kid because I heard the phrase, you cannot serve both God and mammon. And when I asked what mammon was, or who, I was told it meant money. So I got it in my head that money could be evil, and then later I heard that Paul said money is the root of all evil. So God and mammon seemed to me like polar opposites. And yet people would stand up in church and express gratitude for God's blessing, and more often than not, it was for a new job or a raise or something else to do with money. And so it sounded like we serve God and then he rewards us with money. But then I noticed people who served God but didn't get those blessings. And were those people who didn't have enough to eat or pay their rent somehow less deserving of God's abundance? So God and money can be a confusing equation. Today's guest, Reverend Dr. David Lattimore, is the director of the Betsy Stockton Center for Black Church Studies at Princeton Theological Seminary. His teaching and research interests focus on the intersection of religion, race, and economic justice. Before Princeton, Lattimore served as a pastor in Tennessee, Illinois, Florida, and Missouri. Previous to seminary, he had a successful career in investment management and economic development. So before we got to God and mammon, I asked Reverend Dr. Lattimore about how theological training impacts the students at seminaries.
For many students, when they arrive at seminary, they're getting introduced to ideas and thoughts that reflect the breadth and the richness of the Christian story, but it often challenges their perspectives that are formed by their own experiences. The experiences that have formed our early faith defy our ability to always respond rationally. We often say, hey, I don't know why I believe this, but this is the faith of my mom and my grandmother, and so it has provided me some strength. What's beautiful about theological education is, one, it introduces you to the idea that certitude is not the destination. Quite frankly, the more I learn about God, the more comfortable I begin to become with what I don't know about God. I begin to recognize that God is so much greater than my experiences or even what I'm learning, that I begin to grow comfortable with the realization that there are going to be things that I'm going to encounter and that I can't make sense of. Secondly, recognizing that not everything that your grandmother left you is good or bad. So the willingness to hold to your faith lightly, to recognize that the faith that you formed before coming to seminary is not something to simply be abandoned. This is hard-earned faith. So you ought not just give it up easily, but you're going to encounter some better ideas. You're going to encounter better theory around atonement. You're going to come into some contact with some models around Christology that you just had not considered. And so when you come in contact with better ideas, be willing to embrace them. There will be some places where you will say, you know what, I don't know that I can make the argument, but for the time being, I'm going to stick with what my grandmother gave me. I'm going to believe in the power of prayer. I'm going to believe in the goodness of service. This is a place of growing, and it is not a place of final answers. It is a place where we equip people with the tools to engage in important issues, but we trust that you do this engagement in conversation with God, so that God is never absent from the deliberative process. And sometimes God will speak to you in ways beyond the deliberative process. He'll speak to you through the grandmother in the church or through the circumstance that you've encountered. So both have to go hand in hand. And each interrogates the other to lead us to what hopefully are more profoundly impactful decisions and understandings.
You come from a business background, and we'll get into this, your shift from that into theology and ministry, but you're working on a book about the economic history of the Black church with this question, has it been more influenced by economics or theology? So tell me why you delved into that and why that was an important question.
I spent the first 15 years of my career in investment management, and so was deeply steeped into economic thought, finance, and all of the permutations of that particular industry, and later made the transition to more direct and robust engagement in the life of the church. Oftentimes, ideas that were born out of the economic sphere were present in my thinking without my acknowledgement. As an example, I pastored a church in Joliet, Illinois for a number of years, a wonderful congregation and a wonderful place to grow as a pastor. But when I arrived there, I probably asked a question that is not unfamiliar to many men and women who serve in pastoral roles. And that is, so what will success look like? And immediately I said, well, we grow the congregation and we grow the tithes and offering, which was the primary source of funding for the church. And so much of my thinking was really reflective of a business model. Again, nothing inherently wrong with a business model, but a business model requires theological interrogation, and that's what was missing. And so the work that I'm doing around the economic history of the Black church is first to simply tell the story. To what degree have economic phenomena throughout the years influenced the identity and the praxis of all churches, but particularly the African-American church, because our history is so replete with examples of economic deprivation that often renders us more susceptible to the pursuit of economic progress. And again, nothing inherently wrong with that, but to what degree might it lead us down paths that can be rightly challenged by the underlying theology that we espouse as believers?
So every church has some really temporal practicalities to deal with. The parking lot needs redoing. The roof needs redoing. We've got to keep the lights on and the heat or the cooling. So there is no way not to have to deal with those things. Have you come up with a way to measure how you can be sure you're leaning to the spiritual side of that equation and not so overburdened by the economic aspects?
Absolutely. So there is no question, as you rightly say, that we are all bombarded both at the individual and at the institutional level with real material concerns. And ignoring material existence is itself its own danger. So within the African-American church, we have the language around this worldly perspective versus an otherworldly perspective. This worldly is singularly or myopically focused on the concerns of the material existence, and the otherworldly is the perception that all our answers will come to us in the sweet by and by, and when I get to the other side. And that has its own challenges. So no question that we've got to deal with both eternal and temporal, both material and spiritual. But I think that at our best, our theology helps us to respond to these issues as individuals and also as the church. We are each required to both be responsive to material needs that we face, but to not surrender our higher ideas to simply material existence. Notice many of the concerns, the parking lot, the infrastructure, things that I faced all the time as a pastor. Oftentimes when those decisions come up, the decisions are quickly made. We gotta have heat, we gotta have air. We want people to be able to come and to attend our church, so let's expand the parking lot. Reasonable expectations of a church, but do they represent our highest priorities? Should I always pick place over people? Should I divert resources from the care of others to simply expand the parking lot? Why is it that I privilege investment in infrastructure over investment in people? And so I'm not suggesting at all that there's anything wrong with that kind of careful deliberation. But what I hope that churches will do is always wrestle with these questions and not simply privilege the infrastructure or the material over the people that we're called to care for or the community in which we operate, because those concerns can take over. And then our focus is really simply on institutional sustainability, not institutional mission as born out of our faith.
Well, I'm thinking of both scripture and activism. I think it was Gandhi who said there are some people so hungry, the only way God can speak to them is through bread. You can't really be concerned with the spirit if you are so desperate just to preserve your own life.
Absolutely.
And of course, Jesus talks about when I was hungry and you came to me, or naked and you clothed me. So how is economic justice tied to people's spiritual lives?
Well, I think you've rightly quoted Gandhi and really spoken to the core issue. So within economics, as an example, we see a phenomenon or a pull toward being asocial. And by asocial, simply meaning that we privilege the focus on the individual over community. Quite frankly, in much of economic theory, there is the thought that we are intelligent consumers. We understand what baskets of good give us the highest satisfaction. And oftentimes, we prioritize individual satisfaction over any communal investment, except where the communal investment works to the benefit of the individual. The gospel that we pursue is very different. It thinks of communal first and foremost. What can I do for others? With the belief that we serve a God, that if one pursues that God will also care for the individuals. Do the birds give any thought to what they'll wear or the food that's available to them? No, because there is the underlying belief that God will take care of us. Again, there's agency by the individual. So it doesn't mean that we simply sit on the street corner and wait for God to drop off the next potted roast for dinner. But it does say that I don't have to be consumed, even though the culture around me is constantly telling me I should be consumed with individual existence and sustainability, that there is a belief that God will care for you. And so what does that look like when we come together in these communities of church? How do we demonstrate a faith beyond our own agency and a commitment to the care of others? So economic justice requires me to look at the broader context and say, can I be successful? Can I be satisfied if the men and women who walk by my church every Sunday or Monday through Friday or going without while I enjoy so much? And it raises those questions of where does our faith really live in relationship to the men and women that we're blessed to come in contact with, but who may be disadvantaged within our economic system.
How does, or does this even tie in with this phrase that I hear about the prosperity gospel?
I mentioned earlier the challenges within the African-American community because of the history of socioeconomic deprivation. For reasons far more expansive than I can articulate, there has been a real responsiveness to this idea that our faithful service to God will result in our material prosperity. And there is, as it is in most ideas, there is certainly a substance of truth there. I do serve a God that will provide. I serve a God that can and often does answer our needs. I believe that. What I want to suggest, though, and this is where I think prosperity gospel falls short, is the notion that God cannot prosper us even if our material existence suffers. So that prosperity, as we understand it in the broader context of our faith, is not simply defined or tied to material existence, but that we believe we have a God that, though I make my bed in hell, God is there. Though I suffer, God is there. So there's ways of understanding God's providential presence that's not tied to my material existence. It does not mean that God is unconcerned when material conditions are working in disadvantageous ways to human existence. But it simply means that I cannot define the God that I serve or the gospel that I believe in and measure its impact simply by how well I'm doing. And for me, that's not just theology. That's been my own journey. I was born in the city of St. Louis. St. Louis was a highly segregated city. I remember, I've told this many times, I probably was 10 or 11 before I realized America wasn't all black. Everybody in my neighborhood was black. Everybody in my school was black. Everybody at the grocery store was black. I only saw non-black folk on TV. So imagine my chagrin of being disabused of that notion. And I also grew up in a relatively impoverished community. I did not realize that I was impoverished until I got to college because I had what everyone else had. I was in a sociology class. And we were reading a book, Behind Ghetto Walls, which was a book written about the Pruitt-Igoe Projects. It was the first kind of mixed race housing development in America. That's where I was born and grew up in. I can't even describe the feeling of seeing the place that you grew up in described in such stark and economically deprived ways, but that was the reality. Anyway, because of that background, when I went to college, my thought was, well, I've been poor once. Let me not repeat that. And I started in management consulting, moved to investment management, and experienced the material success that comes with that. But at a certain point, I started to serve bivocationally as a pastor in a small church in St. Louis. I quickly realized that to be smart is not the same as being a good pastor, and that I needed additional training, and had a conversation with my wife, and we made the decision that we were going to step away from the investment management arena and that we were going to pursue theological training. And we sold the land and cars. We packed up our houses and we went. We wound up going to Duke and Durham because I could afford to live there based on our savings. And it proved to be the best decision that I've ever made for both me and my family. And there was something deeper and richer that we discovered, even though we no longer had access to some of the same things. We learned some things about our God and ourselves when they were no longer accessible that have enriched our lives in profound ways.
Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I Love is Real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show, and you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Good Faith. I'm speaking with David Lattimore about theological training and God's hand in his life. I wonder if you'd walk us back for just a little bit to the home you grew up in and the role that faith played there.
So both my parents are deceased, but their presence and their spirit lives with me. So I often hear my mom and dad's voice echoing in the background, and I could hear them now saying, you better make sure you tell them how good God has been throughout your lifetime. I grew up in a very religious home. My parents were not formally educated. Both of them had some elementary school experience, but hadn't gotten much past that. But both them and the extended family were deeply steeped in their faith. I attended what we now would refer to as a small sanctified church in St. Louis and spent most of my week at some service at church. And one of the other elements of that experience was it was a church that believed profoundly in you knowing scripture for yourself. So I grew up with Bible quizzes and learning large passages of scripture and that being such an intuitive and constitutive part of my life. And it proved to be of tremendous value. Now, there were some shortcomings. My wife is from New Orleans. Her musical acumen is profoundly greater than my own. I tell all the time, I didn't start listening to secular music till I was well in high school because our radio station stayed on gospel music 24/7. She has a very different cultural upbringing. But mine, until I was probably in high school, was limited specifically to church. And I saw the ways in which that wind up being somewhat problematic for many of the people I grew up with, because by the time they got on their own, they were encountering circumstances for the first time that they didn't always have the skills to engage and unravel because they only had the church experience. But I also have received and understood the good of that, because by the time I was on my own, when I went to college, like most students, I exercised a greater liberty in the activities that I was engaged in. But there was always a constraint. I could only go so far. And there was something about the way in which I had encountered God in my youth that held me firm and said, okay, well, maybe you don't go to church as regularly as you used to, but you're not comfortable trying this or doing this. And so I'm incredibly grateful for that upbringing and the knowledge of the word, which obviously, as I became a pastor, became invaluable.
You talked about the way you had encountered God as a young person. Mm-hmm. And how would you describe that? Was this a sense of presence or a strong belief? What was that for you?
For me, my understanding of God's presence in my life is really retrospective. And I am amazed at how much God's presence in my life reminds me of my presence in my children's life. If you had children, you've had this experience where they have come and with excitement shared something that someone has said to them. And I've sat back in those moments and thought, I've been saying that to you for the last decade, but it took an outside voice for it suddenly to be true. What it means in my children's life is that sometimes my role has been to simply plant seeds, that someone else comes and waters. And if I had not planted it, then maybe it wouldn't have been received even at that later date in the same way. Well, I see the same thing in the way that God has been present. I can look back at multiple times through my life where God has been operative and present, but I didn't always recognize it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later when I looked through a different lens, I could see the way that God operated. I, like most of the young folk in my church and my surrounding, when I was approaching graduation, I was planning on enrolling in the Marine Corps because everyone went to the service as a way of progressing through life. It was just through happenstance that a woman who worked with my mom was a typist at the government center in St. Louis. She was, as mothers often do, bragging about my academic performance and my son has done so well, etc. The woman recommended, well, you should have him take the ACTs and SATs. I wasn't planning on doing that, but something about her presence really influenced my mom to say, you ought to at least try it. And having taken the exams and having done well, she then also encouraged, well, why don't you consider college as well? Had never been on my radar screen. My parents didn't go to college. I was the oldest. Many of the folks in my church hadn't gone. But it was because of that woman's presence there that it planted the seed. It still required me to do my part. But I can't ignore the fact that God was always there. God was always there providing. Even though that provision might seem insufficient to the outside worlds, again, as I grew up, it was more than sufficient for us. So I can look back on my life and I can identify God's careful presence, influencing, planting in my life, developing things that have richly blessed me much later on. And so I celebrate that again, as enthusiastically as my children coming back to me with what they say is now new learning.
Been there, done that. Yes. And all I can do is be grateful to the person who said the thing for saying it and reinforcing.
That's right.
I'm wondering if, because you can look back, you said retrospectively, sort of in the rearview mirror, you see the hand of God. Did that prepare you for when you felt this actual change to leave your profession and to go into ministry and study mission? Did you feel like that was a call, or you somehow felt that God had opened that door? How did you think of that?
Yeah, I certainly believe that it was a call. I think that this is generally true, but it certainly was in my case. Our ability to hear from God is often sharpened in moments where it requires sacrifice. Mm. It is in the moments where there's something at stake that I think can often increase the acuity of our spiritual listening to the voice of God. I very much felt the call on my life with God saying, listen, you have obeyed me and I have blessed you. Now, what are you willing to sacrifice to serve? That question echoed in my heart. It came from my realization that the material success can't be the end all and be all, that life has to be richer than this. And because of the way I was raised, when I close my eyes in this life and I stand before the Lord, what am I going to celebrate, or what's going to be worthy of the gifts that God has and the opportunity that God has given me? So I was keenly aware of the sacrifice. I realized the decision I was making was going to have a generational effect because my kids wouldn't have the same access to things because our material conditions were changing. But I believed that God was still going to provide for us and make a way because God has always been present and God creates multiple paths toward our experiences of abundance. So I think that our trust in God was not guaranteed. There were lots of doubts along the way, questions that we raised, but ultimately we decided we were going to bet on God and not our own ability. And that in part was the result of the upbringing that I had. It was in part the result of the help that I had through my wife and family. And it was in part the result of just God's grace in surrounding us with folk that provided a good influence for us.
How did you see that play out as a pastor?
Well, I've seen it in a couple of ways. I have witnessed God be present in moments where the outcome was not what we desired. And I'm thinking specifically in times that I've been visiting people in hospice, people who are in stage four cancer, people who have been overtaken by sudden physical trauma, and where the outcome was not restoration. It wasn't deliverance. The outcome was the ability to come to a place of peace, to recognize the richness of the journey that they had been on, to find joy in the responses of family and loved ones who were articulating the ways in which their presence had made the difference in their life. I have witnessed God for men and women who were suffering through addiction to provide them with the internal resource to respond to that addiction and lead wholesome and healthy lives, even as they daily wrestled with the temptations of that limitation. I've seen God provide, put food on folks' tables when they didn't have the resources. And God often worked through the community and worked through agencies. But ultimately, it was the providential presence of God that allowed that family to sustain themselves. I remember a young man who wound up serving as a wonderful janitor at our church, but who we came in contact with much earlier in this journey. And there were lots of things that he had to work his way through, but he demonstrated the kind of faithful persistence that God was able to reward. He used the church to provide a job opportunity. He opened up some other doors for the young man. I watched him find a partner, build a family. And these are all things that no one, when he came to us, would have ever envisioned his life. And I've obviously witnessed the same in my own life. We've had financial struggles. We've met times of challenge. And in every moment, God has been present. When I was in seminary, there were a couple of times when things got very challenging financially. My wife has always been a wonderful seamstress. And so she just decided to try her hand at doing curtains. And through a series of events, wind up securing a handful of folk who hired her professionally to do the drapes for their homes. They didn't know it, but those resources came in absolutely critical times for our family. And for me, I think it's both the beauty of my wife's talent, her willingness to work at it, but it was also God's desire and God's effort to be present and provide opportunities for us. So again, in ways big and small, I see too many places where God has been present, and I celebrate that, while I also celebrate the agency of everyone that I've witnessed these testimonies emerge from.
Many thanks to Reverend Dr. David Lattimore for speaking with me. Did you know we have a new podcast? Join Heather Bigley on VoiceOver, Movies That Move Us, for discussions of cinematic epiphanies. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the BYU Radio app. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander, Heidi Hansen, and James Sturtevant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Subscribe to the YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.